For those of you. They broke the mic. Keisha?
Keisha Weather, State Council on Developmental Disabilities. I have several questions.
Okay.
Number one, how restrictive is a STAR home? A North Star South Star home. How restrictive environment is it?
How restrictive an environment is the North Star and the South Star home?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, it's an immediate care facility, and it's at the developmental center. The North Star program is unlocked. The South Star program is, I have to check on the South Star access. Do you know?
I don't know if you can hear me.
It's unlocked. I'm sorry, Dwayne.
It's not a locked facility. Yeah. They do have 24-hour supervision that has at least one-to-one support staffing.
Oh, excellent.
Yeah, so there's a number of support staffing, and those are one of the things that's really important about the work that's being done and reaching out and looking at how the supports will occur in the community. Is also doing the same as far as assessing what's the positive behavioral supports and the models. And that's one of the nice things about having Brad do the work on establishing the model, bringing over the level of clinical expertise to make sure that we can have consistency of the success that's already occurred at the North and South Star.
Oh, excellent. My other question is, what is a community crisis home? What is an IMD?
Oh, I'm so sorry. You know, starting new at the department, I should know better than to talk in acronyms, because for the first couple of months, I have had a hard time knowing what people are talking about. So I apologize for that. IMDs, they're Institutions for Mental Disease.
Mm-hmm.
And so folks who are having acute psychiatric issues sometimes are placed there for stabilization.
Oh, like a psych hospital?
Like college hospital, a psych hospital, yeah.
Yeah. I get it.
And then the CCH is a community crisis home, and those are pretty new homes in the Lanterman Act, and they are really to help support people who would otherwise potentially go to a more restrictive setting like a developmental center or the STAR home or an IMD, an institution for mental disease. And they have we see them as time-limited, 18 months to really help folks stabilize, excuse me, and develop really good supports for them, help them stabilize, and then transition to less restrictive settings.
It's a temporary setting.
Yes, the way it is in statute, it's an 18-month time limit.
Oh, very, very good. And my last comment is, in terms of the safety plan, have you built in a crisis mobile support team? Because I feel that for going into the community, it's very, very important to have a crisis mobile support team that people going into the community can call in case that they need crisis support.
Keisha, this is Nancy. One of the things to remember is that with the safety net plan that and the development that we've outlined,
mm-hmm.
remember, this is in addition to all of the work that the regional centers are already doing. So within each of the regional centers, you can take a look at their emergency response. What are the supports? And so we do have, that's part of the mobile crisis team that is going to be able to be helpful from that state operated.
Oh.
But it's not the only resource that's available in the community. And so one of the things that we're going to have to continue as a state, as a department, is to work with each of the regional centers because many of them have informed their communities the emergency response that they have available,
mm-hmm.
And we can make sure that we continue to have that as part of the communication, because those resources are available, and we need to continue to assess where are the gaps, so if we need to develop more, we can develop more.
Yeah, of course. Fill in the gaps, of course.
Right. And so then also to add on the community crisis homes, That is one of the models that through the work that you all did and the input to talk about what is needed in the community to help provide the community and develop the community as we close the developmental centers. What is that, those resources, the enhanced behavioral supports homes, community crisis homes, those were two new models of service that were developed that really did stem through the input and the hard work that you all did.
That's excellent.
Thanks, Keisha.
Thank you.
Connie?
I'm Connie Lathan. I don't really know you two, but I'm overwhelmed by what you're attempting to do. I mean, overwhelmed in the scope and how many issues you raise that are really important. This is something that's important to me. I'm a parent of a son who's duly diagnosed, actually, and I'm an advocate for people with disabilities and families. And the safety net issue was huge. And DDS did an amazing job throughout the state listening to everybody. We have a lot of documentation, so we know what the problem is. In fact, the place that can't say no resonated with us in the first DC task force. But one of my worries, because I have a son in the Army. I have boots on the ground. I would like a report, and I would like a realistic, we raised this at the last DS task force, when? Because when you say these things, it's so easy to think they're out there. And from my world, there isn't a safety net, really. There's attempts at it. There's good people. I mean, what you're trying to do, it's my dream. It's my dream. And mobile. I echo everything Keisha says. I want to keep people in their homes. In fact, I read the safety net comments in our report, and it's timely and keeping people in their home. But one of the things over time with the DC task force and the DS task force is what exists today. So I would love a report on that. And then the other thing I want to ask you is, I have learned through, you know I'm going to say the word, self-determination, that families and consumers need to feel kind of in charge of their lives. And it's so important that you talk to them also, what is needed. Because I can tell you, one of the tricks is called relationships. It's not a behavioral home. It's not, and we lose that sometimes in trying to help. I was a speech pathologist my other life, so I know what it's like to kind of be on the other side and want to help and make things happen. I applaud you for what you're doing. I'd love you to have my phone number. I would love to live in your office and help you, but this is the place that, and I'm an older parent. I make a joke of it, but it's not funny. And that's our fear. What happens in a crisis? And so thank you for what you're doing, but I would like to have information about, you mentioned, I couldn't write it all down, and I don't think it's in here, right?
No.
Okay. We don't have it all written down, but we can look at summarizing everything and getting a summary out so you can have updates. Well, I think that would be helpful, and we can look at how we can do that.
Yeah, because it's just real, you know what, it's the truth. It's the reality factor. If I were to hear that and I was in trouble, I'd yeah, I can go to that one in the north and the south, and then maybe I'll call the mobile team, and you know, and we just have to see what's out there. But I really think that families and consumers have a lot to tell you about what causes a crisis. And sometimes it isn't more complicated than just having a friend and a relationship. I mean, I know there's medical issues. I'm not minimizing.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Catherine Blakemore, and thanks for your work on that and your engagement of our staff. I think there's just two things I'm not clear on from the presentation, and it's entirely possible I missed something, so apologies if I did. But with the North Star, I understand you're developing over the next 2 years, 3 5-bed homes, it looks like. And are they designed to be in the same part of Northern California, or you don't know yet? It sounded like they were maybe in the North Bay catchment area, but
yeah,
as they are?
As of now, the focus is to look in North Bay catchment area as far as the first two homes, and then the next home is after that. Because of staffing and being able to use and the resources of each of the homes and the staff that will be working, having them within a certain geographic area together is really going to be necessary. But it doesn't mean that there's not going to be access to services for somebody who's in a different geographic area, just as we do now at the North Star and South Star. And then also we'll have the support of the mobile crisis staff, because the team that is working at the North Star Community Homes will also be a part of the mobile crisis. So you have collectively, so we are looking in those geographic areas. And the reason why you're not getting saying, okay, this is the neighborhood of the city, because when you take a look at the Sonoma, Santa Rosa area, they have obviously been significantly impacted by the fires. So we just need to see what does that mean. And so we've already started those discussions to say, okay, if there's the houses and the stock of housing is not available, what do we do? You know, because we're not going to delay the development. Do we need to take a look at a build from the ground up? Do we need to take a look at, so we're looking at all of those things immediately, so we're not delaying the development.
Can we find anybody who can build from the ground up? I think
yes.
Probably the same question. But anyway.
Yes.
And then for the folks that are in IMD, so what I heard you say was you were developing 4 community crisis homes, and that's, I'm interpreting that to be that's where people are transitioning to?
Do you want to answer that? Or?
Yeah, so with the IMDs and looking at the transition homes, so they were also tailored to be temporary. It wasn't tailored to be that these were the long-term, and it's not for everybody. So currently we have, as you know, about 60 individuals, but that number rotates. Mm-hmm. Now, the discussions that through the different meetings and stakeholder meetings that we had, part of the input that we received, one of the priorities was clearly we need to limit the amount of time that individuals are in the acute psychiatric settings in IMDs. And what we were finding is that while there is a period of time of having individuals to stabilize in acute psychiatric settings, wasn't particularly the problem in some instances, because stabilization is critical. It's making sure that there's a resource for them to transition to, you know, whether it's a ongoing or shorter term, if there still is more intense supports that need to occur. So the design of those 4 homes was particularly into making sure that individuals are not spending any significant length of time, any longer than medically necessary, in the acute psychiatric. Doesn't mean that everybody has to go that route. You know, the first priority is to make sure that they find their first transition to the home that is a permanent home, that they don't need to move again. But as an alternative, as not having them stay in the acute psychiatric setting, that's why the models were being set up.
So I guess 2 observations. One is, I mean, what we know is the statutory timeline for people in IMDs is generally not happening. So it's 6 months, that's, you know, kind of people are supposed to be done. But so I'm hoping people are not still in crisis. That's sort of the misnomer part. Like, you're going to go from an IMD to a community crisis home. Mm-hmm. One would hope you're not in crisis after 4 years of being in an IMD. So it's a little hard to reconcile those 2 things. But I guess in addition, like, you know, the preventing people into IMDs, those seem like the appropriate places for people to go rather than be in an IMD, right? So if you're developing these, so it's essentially, you know, 16 slots that people can go to, given the number of people that go into IMDs, I guess I would encourage that we're sort of thinking about that as models to avoid placement, because then we don't have the headache of getting them out, but it doesn't really solve then the problem for the 59 people who are still living in IMDs, many of whom have been there for as long as, well, we know at least 4 years, because we stopped counting after 48
wow.
months. So
yeah.
there are
yeah.
people who are clearly there longer than that period of time. So and I
we're
guess
not,
it's sort of figuring that part out, I think.
Yeah, and I think that's, you're actually saying some of the exact same things, the internal discussions that we've been having mm-hmm. as far as enhanced behavioral supports home versus community crisis homes, what model is really going to be able to meet the best need for this purpose. And it for the exact points that you're bringing up, it may be that the EBSH, that they're really not that dissimilar, you know, other than some of the requirements for the community crisis home. So we're at a place where we have still plenty of time to distinguish between the difference. And so if it's more appropriate through our discussion and development with the regional centers to go to an enhanced behavioral supports home, that's something that is perfectly supported. Yeah.
Or it just may suggest the need for, you know, additional kind of capacity,
sure.
Right? So you have a need. I'm not disputing the need for community crisis homes. I think it's a really good model, but that just may not solve the problem for, because I can see those beds, you know, being filled very quickly so people avoid placement in IMD, and then we simultaneously need to develop, you know, other kinds of arrangements. And I know you're going to talk about the guidelines for the community kind of development plans ongoing, and I'm hoping we're going to look at that in sort of the breadth of things, sort of how do we, you know, what are the current barriers that people experience that might result in them being in a crisis, from everything from they can't, you know, they're told they have to use IHSS as opposed to behavioral services because that's a generic service, and that's a barrier to them being able to manage the crisis effectively, all the way to people who are really in an acute crisis who need an interim step and then need to get out of that crisis home into something else. So.
Yep. Yeah, thank you. Yeah, no, we'll take a look at all of those elements. So going down there, Will, I think, was next.
Will Sanford. Yeah, I was just reinforce on the transition. One of the challenges we've had is we've created crisis or transition homes that then become full and no one ever leaves. So you have deadlines or timeframes on those, but do we actually have the funding mechanism in place so that when people are ready, you know, medically or whatever the appropriate term is to move on, they move on and aren't kept in, because if they move out, then there's a financial burden and the vendor can't maintain that home. So are we looking at a model that says we are actually have a stability for fiscal operations in that, so that people can actually move through it? So what we've seen in the past is we've developed those homes. They're great for the first four people. And wait a minute, those four people are still there 48, 6 years. So they don't actually transition through. So while we have time frames, I just want to make sure that we have the funding model in place that actually supports having two open beds. Because that's often been a huge problem for the maintenance of those kind of things. The other one is, several years ago, Department of Social Services did a whole lot of work on the restraint and containment regulations. I don't think they ever issued them, but you should at least have a conversation related to that, because it did take a real long look at what they were willing to go down the path of what to be used. Yeah, no, but it was one of the, but they did at least have that conversation going on. Did they ever issue those? No, but they work was a significant chunk of work.
Yeah. Yeah, we're working and looking at the totality to make sure that everything works together. This is, we're looking forward to actually, and I think really have to thank DRC in being really a great lens as we work through and taking a look at the things that we need to as we're developing the new models. And so it's been a really good discussion. Yeah, thank you, Will. Carol?
Will was talking about is what happens when the person is living in their own apartment community and then they move into one of these homes for a period of time. How is their apartment maintained? If you don't have the maintain your apartment, then you have no place to move back to. So that's critical in this.
Yeah, and that part of the discussions, and we'll continue to use that input as far as with the community crisis homes as one of the models as far as supports. Remember, there's a lot of different models that are available to provide supports, and we need to continue to assess if we have gaps in that. Is that looking at how to be able to and having the ability to make sure that the ongoing stability of funding for their current resource as stabilization is occurring. And we'll continue to keep that as part of the discussions and priority.
Right. Hi, Ron Cohen from UCP of Los Angeles. My question is in regards to the real estate for one of these homes, let's say in Southern California that you're doing with San Gabe and Orange County. What is the cost, the total cost of acquisition, rehab, and service, paying your mortgage until you fill the home and you have an income? Do you have an idea of what that would be?
So California, as you know, has so many different markets of housing. And so what's happening with the model, just to give you a little bit of background, is that when the regional center is vendored, then vendoring a housing development organization that's developing the housing to do the acquisition and then to do the renovation. The CPP dollars are used to assist with a down payment, and then the CPP dollars are used to assist with the renovation to help the home, you know, A, be in ADA compliance, but also to meet the unique needs of the individuals. So across the state, it's very different. But you're seeing about $250,000 that go for the down payment. The average cost of homes, depending on if you're in Moreno Valley or if you're in a northern part of Northern California, like in Sonoma, are vastly different. So part of the work has been in making sure that there's the economics work as far as how much of the down payment that's going down, and that the ongoing kind of lease cost is something that's supported within the rate. So all of those factors that the regional center has to bundle up to present to the department before they can get approval to acquire a particular home. And then the renovation. So renovation, you're seeing, depending on the type of home that's being developed, so your specialized residential facilities, you may see about $200,000. You know, I'm doing this off the top of my head. On an average, you might see about $200,000 for renovation. But where you might see with an ARF cushion, where the specialized residential development, because of the tracking systems and the generators and the size of the bathrooms for gurneys, you know, and then also with the enhanced behavioral supports homes with some of the extra specialized services, you might be seeing everything from $350,000 to $500,000 as far as some of the renovation. And then during the time, one of the things, your debt service that you're talking about, who covers that as the home is ramping up replacements, I think, Ron, was your question, is that with the enhanced behavioral supports homes and with the community crisis homes, as we know, those rates, based on the input that we received, were established to be able to fund for the hard cost, kind of those set costs, the lease, the first staffing, and all of that until the home is full. So that was established through the development of those resources. That said, through CPP, is that there's a transition cost that is supported. So both for the housing organization and the service provider, CPP dollars can help with that transitional time, say for 6 months. So you can have all of the startup, the debt service can be covered, you know, as the placements are occurring in the home. It's not an open, not something that happens for 2 years. It's a very time limited, but it is built into what the guidelines allow for the use of the funds for that transitional period. Does that answer your question?
No.
Okay. Well, then tell me.
I mean, does it cost, in your experience, $8, $1.5 million, let's say, Southern California, North in Los Angeles, in all these, where 50%, I believe, of our population live. You're talking San Diego, LA, Bay Area. They're all high cost communities.
Are you asking purchase price or CPP dollars?
Yeah, how much is it costing us?
Well, if you buy a house, different questions, Ron. So.
Well, I know if you buy a house and you only put $250,000 down and your house costs $1 million, that's a pretty big debt
right.
service that has to now go into a rate so the provider can, or the listing person can meet that.
So what we can do is I can get you kind of average costs, you know, because there's been, and Tiffany's not here, so she's like our walking encyclopedia of CPP. I'm trying to think. There's been over 200 homes, about 200 homes that have been acquired. And of all of the homes, I think there's about 10% of them that are $1 million, about $1.1 million is the purchase price. Everything else is about between $200,000 all the way up.
Okay.
So, again, based on the different geographic areas.
Okay.
So, and this includes development that's occurred from the time of development for Agnews to current day.
Okay.
And so that's just with the housing development it's not including when you, as a service provider, are developing independently from a housing organization.
Right.
So there's, we can absolutely take a look at having more discussions. And again, it may be an area that you want to look at when we talk about what are the discussions area that, as a task force, you want to have some discussions going forward.
And I ask these questions for the next conversation when it comes into the rate setting methodology.
Sure.
And that's why I'm asking these questions, because I just got done talking to Catherine before the meeting started from a regional center who's saying, we don't have housing. There's nowhere to put our guys. And I see the programs that are closing and the housing that's closing in where we are in Southern California, and we have regional center directors who are putting people up in hotels.
So maybe that's... So,
if we know what it costs now in today's dollars to start a home, that conversation needs to be used when we start talking about rate setting, because if I close homes that I bought in $1980 for $150,000 or less, and I go out of business because the rate setting isn't right, someone's going to have to then create new homes and replace what we just closed. So that's why I was asking those questions, really, for future conversations.
And I think that, let's go ahead and put that, because I think it's future conversations, but there's also a big conversation, you know, because we're talking about a number of areas. So absolutely. And as a group, we've had a work group on housing. And that's just like many of the things that we work on. This is an ongoing discussion. This is not something that the work is done yet. We need to still have that conversation. So absolutely. Thanks, Ron. Christine, did you have something?
Yeah, first of all, thank you so much for your hard work and your effort. And this is clearly an indication that we're going down the road of addressing an issue that was really very important to me personally and professionally, to ensure that a very extreme population that is currently being served in the DCs has the proper support once they move out of the DCs. So I just want to clarify, the two mobile crisis teams that you're talking about, are those directly funded by the state of California?
Yes, so directly funded by the state.
They don't go through the vendorized system and the regional center that you folks are putting together, a couple of elite teams.
Mobile crisis is state operated, correct.
Okay, all right. But the community crisis teams, from the conversation I'm hearing, is going through the regular vendorized service with the regional centers.
Correct. You have many regional center services that are provided that are either vendored, or some of them have some of their operations team that also provides some supports as well.
Is there any possibility down the road? I know, listening to the comments made, there's obviously some real issues that are at work here that might be a barrier to people deciding to apply for vendorization for this type of home. Has any consideration been made to the idea of going ahead and directly funding that through the state also, just the community crisis homes that are being proposed?
To have them as state operated?
Just like the DCs were, only of course they're not going to look at all like the DCs.
So, no, I'm going to answer it in two ways. One is that the STAR services that are currently in operation, so the North STAR and the South STAR, the plan is expanding those. So the North STAR will have three homes in the community mm-hmm. that will be state operated. And then in the South STAR, we'll have two homes instead of the ones that are serving up to 10 individuals. That will be state operated. So in addition to that, the community crisis homes will be out in the community within the regional centers that will be vendored by the regional center and provided through the community crisis home.
But there will be a number of them that will be funded.
Correct. Okay. We will have a total of five STAR homes once we develop everything that will be state operated. Okay. So, and I don't think we're calling them star homes in the future, but for easy reference, I am today.
So all I have further to say is, woot, woot.
We like that.
Very excited. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Mark?
Yeah, so Mark Barr, SEIU Local 1000. So as someone who has skin in the game, both as a task force member and the development and conception and birthing of this program, and also someone who has boots on the ground, being a team member of the original crisis program that was developed at Fairview, and then a very proud member of the STAR program, I just want to thank the department for all the work you've done on this. This is a happy day for me today to see this, you know, the development we've made with this. Questions I have, though, is concurrently the STAR program I'm involved with, you know, the educational and vocational side of it. That pretty much we depend on the support of the DC for our vocational services, are, you know, because just our people are paid for the jobs they do. So I guess one of my questions is, moving forward and we're spinning out of that, how are we going to handle the vocational side of it and educational side of it? Also, too, right now, I believe the funding for that is 25%. That's what the duty statement for instructor was on that. So is that expanding with the expansion of more homes? So I guess those are the two questions I have.
Yeah, I don't know, Brett, if you have even worked through that detail yet or if that's still pending.
Yeah, we know at the North Star, I oversaw the North Star program prior to coming to DDS, a senior psychologist at Sonoma Developmental Center. So it was great to hear that you were a part of the Fairview acute crisis. We know how important it is to help stabilize individuals by providing education and getting them involved in vocational programs at the STAR program. We haven't quite worked through how that's going to look like, what that's going to look like in the new STAR, but it's definitely an identified service need. And I just don't have the answer as to what that would look like. We've had some internal discussions on different options, but I don't have an answer for you today. I'm sorry.
So you haven't developed any duty statements or anything else regarding, I mean, is the teaching position or whatever going to continue on with that? Or
there's a lot of elements, Mark. I think that it's a great question. And there's still elements and pieces, the detail of it, that we still have to work through. And that's one of the pieces. But I echo what Brad is saying. Thank you for the work that you helped in being a part of it and your continued work. But we will we'll make sure that we communicate back with you and make sure you get the answer to your question.
Perfect. Thanks.
Thank you, Mark. Marty, Terry.
Terry raised your hand first.
All my questions and more have been answered.
Oh, I just hate because she happens to be last as she goes last where she's sitting. Marty Emoto, City Can, and again, thank you for all the work that you've done. And like Connie, I don't really know you both, and maybe you prefer it that way, but we're going to be probably, all of us, much more in touch talking with you both, definitely. So I have a couple of questions, and one of them has to do with echoing the comments made by the others on the task force. The first one is about resources and funding and capacity, not just in the, you know, the crisis homes and that, but afterwards. And that raises to Ron's point is, you know, if we have a pipeline to move people out of crisis, the problem in the past has always been that the pipeline gets stuck and people who are supposed to be transitionally in a certain restrictive setting end up staying there, as Catherine pointed out, you know, for years. And so the state needs to, and collectively us as a task force needs to, and also the rate study needs to look at how do we collectively create the resources that allow a person to be moved into a less restrictive setting and not necessarily wait for the rate study, but to do things as a pilot to test out some new ideas. Because that's so critical, because as Ron pointed out, it's not, well, Ron raised the issue of housing, but it's not just that. It's also the support staff necessary to staff the housing or the less restricted environment, any other staffing that's required to mobilize, the effort to make sure that they don't return back into crisis. Tied to that is the issue of disparities, and again, I mentioned this before, that the issue of reducing disparities should be a part of everything we do. So that stakeholder group of yours that you formed, I would really encourage, I wasn't part of that group, but I don't need to be, but making sure that we have outreach to community-based organizations that have connections to communities of color. Because one of the things we talk about capacity, not only during when a person's in crisis, but afterwards, is that that's kind of, we measure that by what we know. But if communities of color don't know that these options are available, or that other options, or there are certain state laws or regulations that prohibit someone remaining in a restrictive setting, then they're not going to access the right services. And so disparities needs to be something that happens, or that we reduce it in everything. And this is crucial. My own family, for instance, with my sister, we went from crisis to crisis later on in her life. We had no idea what was available out there. And how we reacted to a crisis was basically whatever we can find. And it was desperate. And you know what? It was never the best choice. It was always, it ended up in a tunnel or down the hill towards a more restrictive setting. And you get desperate and, you know, you don't know what's out there. And so I just really encourage that part of this whole idea of building capacity and resources when a person's in crisis is also building outreach to the right to all the communities, working with the regional centers, but CBOs, community-based organizations. And then the other piece has to be about building the capacity on the other end. Lastly, the reporting is so crucial. And Catherine and others, and both Catherines actually, and all of us as advocates, it's great that the state is doing these things, and we know they exist, these alternatives. But we also know that people have remained in restrictive settings for years. And that's despite the oversight of the legislative committees, despite the, you know, the oversight of the advocates and, you know, the department. So I'm really wondering, you know, it's not going to be solved in this meeting, the reporting that measures the outcomes, not only of how we move people out of, you know, in crisis, but afterwards. Because it's one thing to move them through the pipeline, right? But afterwards, and what kind of measurements are we producing in that you can report out not only to us, but to the policymakers? Because that's so crucial. So thank you. And again, thank you for everything you're doing.
Marty, thank you for
My biggest challenge sometimes. Are we on? Can you hear me?
I think your biggest challenge is a good mic, actually.
Yeah, I don't think it's Carlos. Well, Carlos needs to sit there, though.
Carlos must be on the phone.
We're bullying
Carlos. Or does he have to point at that white receiver on the wall, and it can't be blocked
by. Oh. Okay, now we know the secret. Point at the white wall. So several things, Marty, that you brought up that I just want to kind of react to, which I think is really helpful. The first, of, I think, having the discussion regarding no matter what we do is through the lens of making sure that cultural sensitivity, competency, and looking at how to make sure that information, service development, anything we do is through the lens. And we all need to continue to have that conversation. So please keep that. But you'll find that even at the department, as we have directives that are going out, or we have, oh my gosh.
Do I sound like I'm sick? There we go. So anytime we have directives or communication, we really, that is over the last year and a half, that's one of the kind of one of the things that I think is really becoming a almost like a mantra at the department, where we're going and saying and asking each other, okay, how are we kind of blending that in? So please keep that discussion going and count on you to help us help us do that. The other is that talking about the IMDs, Leanne had mentioned it. One of the things that we are doing is having those monthly calls, and I'm reiterating what she just shared, or it's actually quarterly calls with the regional centers, and then it's quarterly, taking a look at what is the detailed plan, what is the development, what are the resources for those next steps. Because to your point, we need to make sure that we have those ongoing resources. And again, you know, we have the enhanced behavioral supports homes and community crisis homes. We are now in the benefit of having the homes come online. So it has taken us a couple years, probably 3 years, to ramp them up. So I don't have the number of the homes right now in at my fingertips, but the number of resources that are being developed to build that community capacity to meet that need is just going to explode here shortly. Will it meet all of the needs? Probably not. And that's where we still need to assess what else do we need to do. But I'm really excited about the number of enhanced behavioral supports homes and then also the support services that can go in the wraparound to those that are living in supported living services. So we have more work to do, but I do see the development that's coming on the cusp. And we'll have more conversations later on this afternoon on the community development and where we need to go with that. So thank you for that. And then Terry?
Yes, you know, this is really wonderful. One of the recommendations of the Future of Developmental Centers Task Force was to leverage the use of the developmental center assets defined as employees and programs and land. And this is really kind of a triple whammy with the use of, is it Mark Lane on the Fairview campus? So this is really wonderful. I'm very excited about it. My understanding is, please tell me if I'm correct, that the use of this expansion of the STAR units and also the mobile crisis teams, that there is sort of built-in robust data collection to see its utilization and its value, and we will get reports on that?
Yes, right? We're building the data, but we can also review what is going to be developed to see, you know, if you have additional input on it. And that goes back to the other point of where Marty was bringing up on the data. If you remember some of the data that we had with the task force, and we take a look at that over time, if you want more data than, you know, and look at it differently, we can absolutely change it. We have the data regarding the individuals that have, say, gone into jail. How many times, how over the years. So there's a number of things we can continue to do to drill in to see where we need to kind of build in those gaps. So we can have some data discussions as well. I like that. Thank you. Connie, and then we're going to end the conversation on Safety Net because we are pretty far behind.
And I didn't do it. And this is Connie Lapin. One of the things this shows me that we need to meet more than once a year. I don't know how we planned these groups, but this was a very, as you can see, I mean, we had to take turns. It's a very important, significant area, and we're seeing such amazing progress, but we need to talk about it more. I just want to bring up the area of psychiatric care. And we talked about it from the first day we started the DC Task Force. Do we have good psychiatric care? Do we know a good psychiatrist? Keisha and I do. And this over-medication issue. And so that plays a part, a really significant part. And I don't know how you get a handle on that.
Okay. Thank you, Connie. Going forward today, we should be ending the presentation right now of Burns and Associates. So what is the group's pleasure? We can either go ahead and see how much time. Oh, there you are. You don't have a flight out at 2:00 or anything, do you? Okay. Yes, all night. Do you want to have the presentation, which we anticipate 45 minutes to an hour, for the discussion on from Burns and Associates? Do you want to do that now, or do you want to take a brief lunch and then come back and start with that? And then we'll, Connie, I promise you I'm not going to ignore the determination discussion.
Oh, I didn't even, yes, I swear.
We will, I want to just make sure that we, but I will definitely do the HCBS and self-determination update as well. Group.
You are working on it, kind of working on it.
working lunch or take a break? Just real quick.
How about, do you want to do a 30-minute break and then start?
Yeah.
Okay. So we will, well, I think some people don't have lunch and they have to go get it. Yeah. So let's go ahead. We will break for 30 minutes. What time is it now? We will return at 12:30, and we will see you shortly.
I just think that went okay.
Hello, operator?
Yes, I am here.
I'm going to change my phone because my phone is like, my other phone is not working. So I'm going to change it because I'm trying to put it on mute, and I'm going to put it on mute. So I'm going to call back on the same line, but with different phone, but that'll solve it.
Okay, are you going to call back after your break?
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm calling back at 12:25.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, thank you, operator.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Hey, Stacy, operator? Operator?
I have to talk to the sky.
There's no other way. Operator, we're getting ready to start again. Are you there?
This is Heather. I'm still on here, although I'm not the operator.
Oh, good. Nice to talk to you. We're getting ready to start again.
Fabulous. Thank you.
I probably have it in one of Jim's.
And this is King, from the AT&T communications person. This conference call is still active. And we do have some lines connected on the phone as well.
This is Stacy. Can you hear me? Heather?
Yes.
Yes, your call is ready to go. Yes.
All right.
Thank you.
Operator, this is Heather. Are we still on?
Yes, you are.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
Do you want that one instead of the answer?
I can use this one if you want it, because where's Burns and Associates going to sit?
Okay.
So they probably need this one.
Yeah.
Okay. So we're going to go ahead and get started. We have, do you want to introduce Burns and Associate and just give background? So John Doyle, Chief Deputy Director, is going to introduce Burns and Associate and for our presentation regarding the rate study.
Come on up, you guys.
Hi, good afternoon, everybody. John Doyle of DDS. I wanted to introduce Stephen Pawlowski, who is the lead for Burns and Associates on our rate study. Steve, Carl, would you also stand up so people can get to see your faces too? Steve and Carl are also part of the team. They are going to be, they've been working with us on the study, and they will be reaching out to consumers, to families, to advocates, to providers, and they'll be sending out a provider survey to have everyone participate in that survey. We'd like to get as many people as possible participating in that survey, because the better informed it is, obviously, the better the work will be on the study. So the more information we have, we're hopeful it'll make the results more comprehensive. So, anyway, with that, I will turn it over to Stephen Pawlowski. He's got a presentation that I think was distributed to all members, so everybody should have it, and folks on the phone can follow along with what was sent out.
And then one of the things we'll want to do is ask if you have questions.
Good afternoon, everyone. Is the mic coming across? Just barely. Any better? A little bit better? Okay. Thank you. Let me make sure I'm set up here. Perfect. So as John said, my name is Stephen Pawlowski. I'm the Vice President of Burns & Associates. I'm joined today by a couple of my colleagues sitting in the conservative suits there in the front row, Stephen Obley and Carl Matzinger. I appreciate the opportunity to meet with the task force here today. This is going to be a first in what I expect to be a number of meetings that we're going to be having over the course of the next 12 to 15 months or so. So what we have today to talk about is a pretty high level and reasonably quick overview orientation to our organization, a little bit about our experience in setting rates for IDD systems. We'll talk a little bit about our general approach, and then we'll talk a little bit more specifically about what we intend to do here in California pursuant to the rate study contract that we have here. So wanted to spend just a moment talking a little bit about our organization. Burns & Associates is a health policy consulting firm headquartered in Phoenix, Arizona. We have a smaller satellite office in the greater Washington, D.C. area. We were established in 2006 by our founders, who were actually partners in a predecessor consulting firm that was headquartered in the Washington, D.C. area. We really live and breathe Medicaid. This is probably 90 to 95% of our work is within the Medicaid space. We do a little bit of additional work in the human services area, mostly in Arizona, based upon some of the connections that we have in prior work experience. Medicaid really is what it is we do day in, day out. within the large Medicaid universe, we also have a specialty in intellectual and developmental disabilities, and that's actually one of my roles at Burns & Associates is I had our IDD practice. So within IDD, we do an awful lot of different things. Certainly, rate setting is a big part of what we'll be doing, and that's what we will talk today about. We also have spent a lot of time in recent years working with other organizations and states to implement new assessment instruments and use those assessments to inform rates and individualized budgets. And then we do some work on the operational side as well, reviewing service definitions, helping states with coding issues that they're having in terms of their procedure codes modifiers, writing service definitions, assisting with negotiations with CMS on new waivers, and the like. I'm going to talk a little bit in more detail about each of these rate studies in just a minute. And I should have said before I jumped right in, I was so excited to get started to give you just a housekeeping item or two. I've given a presentation like this a time or two in the past, so I have a tendency to speak pretty quickly, and I know that we have a limited time to work with here this afternoon. I certainly encourage members of the task force, if you have questions as I'm going along, please feel free to interrupt me and ask those. It gives me an opportunity to take a drink of water, so I actually appreciate those occasional interruptions. Otherwise, I get on a roll and I start talking over myself. We are joined on this particular contract by a couple of subcontractors, one of which I would imagine many of you are already familiar with. But first, we have the Human Services Research Institute. They're a nonprofit headquartered in Cambridge, Massachusetts. We're actually working with their Portland, Oregon office. And they do an awful lot of work in the human services field, including within the intellectual and developmental disability space. We've actually partnered with them on a lot of projects over a number of years. Their specialty is really working with people with disabilities. So they do a lot of work around self-advocacy. They actually publish a newsletter called The Riot, which is written by self-advocates. So that comes out, I think, on a monthly or maybe quarterly basis. They do a lot of work around assessment instruments as well, so helping states adopt new assessment instruments, do validation work on assessments. They do work in terms of establishing individualized budgets so that people are empowered. They're allotted a certain amount of money for their plan year, and then they're empowered to make decisions about how they want to use that money. They also work with the American Association on Intellectual and Developmental Disabilities on the National Core Indicators Project, so they were one of the founding organizations of the NCI, so they're obviously intimately involved in that as well. In terms of their role on this particular contract, they're going to be assisting us with some of the work around to what extent do we have rates that are going to vary based upon individual levels of need, because that is, again, one of the things that they specialize in, and certainly going to also serve as one of the liaisons when we're engaging with self-advocates and asking them about what's important to them as relates to the system, the IDD system, and how the rates can support those policy goals. As John said, that's one of our things, one of the things on our to-do list over the coming months, is start to expand the number of groups that it is we're involving in this process. Our second subcontractor on this particular engagement is Mission Analytics Group. They've actually been working with the California DDS as well as the Regional Center since 2005 as the risk management contractor. So we're looking to them to bring a kind of California-centric perspective on the work. We have a lot of work in the IDD space, but not in California in particular, so they're going to help fill some of those gaps and have helped us hit the ground running. And then certainly they also have a powerful analytics shop, so they'll also be assisting in some of the data analytics work that we're doing. We'll talk a little bit more about some of the specific components of this particular project, but the legislation that requires this rate study also requires that the rates look at things like quality outcomes, disparities, and the like. So between HSRI and Mission, I think we have our bases covered in terms of both the qualitative and quantitative expertise to make sure that we're not just looking at rates in isolation, but also looking at what some of these other impacts that rates have in the system are. So, like politics, all rate studies are local, and I really hadn't intended to spend a lot of time talking about our work in other states in the course of doing this presentation to this group as well as to some other groups, but I think it's important to spend just a couple brief minutes talking about some of the work that we've done in other jurisdictions. It, again, speaks to our experience setting IDD rates, but I've also heard from an individual or two that there's some misperceptions about the results of our work elsewhere across the country. So I think it's, rather than focusing on one or two states that folks have brought up, it's important for you to take a broader perspective on the results of our work across the country. So I don't want to dwell on any of these because, again, we're not here to guarantee any potential outcome, any particular outcome here in California. We go where the data tells us and based upon policy decisions that are made at the statewide level. But I think this provides some perspective, again, on the results and the aims of these other clients that we've had in the past. So really, our work setting IDD rates began in Arizona, our home state, and it actually began before our firm was established. I mentioned we were kind of born out of a previous consulting firm. That previous consulting firm was working in Arizona since 2003. We've done three soup-to-nuts rate-setting engagements in the state of Arizona, so 2003-ish, 2008-ish, and then 2013, 2014. They're statutorily required to review their rates every 5 years. So the first rate study that we did as Burns & Associates in 2008 was used to justify rate increases that occurred between 2004 and 2008 of 22%. I mentioned that our most recent rate study was in 2013 and 2014. At that point in time, we recommended a 26% rate increase on average. Certainly, some rates were increased by more than 26% and others by less than 26%, but on average, across all services, our recommendation was 26%, which would have cost the state $188 million. To this point, our legislature has balked at funding what it is we recommended back in 2013, 2014. That being said, they have provided modest rate increases since the 2013-14 rate study of about 1 to 3% on an annualized basis. So since then, providers have gotten about 6, 7, 8% rate increase depending upon the service that they're delivering. Georgia is another state that we've been working in for a number of years. We first did a rate study in 2010, and the rates that we proposed at that point in time, kind of on guidance from the state, were cost neutral. For a number of reasons, providers of particular service pushed back in that particular rate study, and those rates were not ultimately implemented. We were re-engaged by the state in 2015 to look at just a couple of particular services, residential services, group homes, and host homes, in-home services, which they call community living support, and then respite services. The rates that we proposed in 2015 were an overall increase of 24% or $74 million. We worked with the state, we worked with the governor's office, and ultimately with the legislature and had that fully funded. So ultimately, CMS took a little bit of time to approve the waiver amendment that was required, not because of the rate site, but because of some DOJ settlement issues. But we finally got approval for our waiver amendments, or the state's waiver amendments, in March of 2017, and implementation began that same month. I was actually in Georgia last week working through some of the implementation issues that providers are facing. But that $74 million is already flowing through the community. Rhode Island worked there in 2011, I think. They were actually doing a number of different things in Rhode Island. They had a legacy rate system where rates were paid to providers on a bundled monthly basis, so providers were given a monthly payment to do good things on behalf of the individuals. They wanted to move to a more typical fee-for-service system where most services are reimbursed on a 15-minute basis, which is really the norm across the country, for most services at least. And they also wanted to move to adoption of the supports intensity scale to assess the levels of need of individuals, and then pay rates that vary based upon that level of need. So for residential and day program services, because folks with more substantial needs need more intensive staffing, there were higher rates paid for folks with higher needs than with lower needs. So this is a good example of how things are oftentimes outside of our control or even outside of our clients' control. We proposed rates, and then that was in the height of the Great Recession. The legislature came behind what we proposed and said the department, BUDA, the Behavioral Health Developmental Disabilities and Hospitals Agency, had to cut services by $24 million. So that came out of rates. So if you look at the literature, a lot of the blame for that has been blamed on my organization, but the rates that we proposed were never implemented into the state, have never been implemented. The legislature simply said, we have to make cuts across the board. This is what the DD agency's share is, and that's what they ultimately had to do. So to this day, some of the rates that are being paid in Rhode Island are less than we proposed back in 2011, just because the legislature has not found the funding to fully reinstate the cuts that happened during the Great Recession. New Mexico, another project that happened during the Great Recession. They were looking to do a number of different things as well, changing a lot of service definitions. It was part of a waiver redesign, a waiver reauthorization project. They needed to move away from a homegrown assessment instrument based upon feedback they got from legislative staff that was pretty clearly demonstrating that the assessment just was not functioning properly. So they also adopted the SIS. This is a state that, in fact, we did recommend rate reductions on an average basis. Some rates were recommended for increases, but overall, we did recommend that rates be reduced by about 4% or $10 million. Those rates were implemented. That being said, the state did not look to recoup those dollars. Those dollars were redeployed, to reduce the waiting list. So although $10 million were taken out of provider rates, it was reinvested in the system to bring people back into service. Maine. Yes, sir.
Yes, go ahead. Will Sanford, real quick on that one. So the reduced rates was to increase access. Did it actually increase access?
In terms of the number of people receiving services?
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. By whatever the equivalent of $10 million was. I mean, their average per member per year spending is about $75,000, so that per person. I have to go back and look at the specific numbers, but what's interesting is the amount of money spent before the rate increase and the amount of money spent after the rate increase was within $100,000. There was almost no change. So although rates were reduced, all of the money was put back into expanding services to people, or bringing more people into services more specifically, reducing the waiting list. Yes, ma'am.
Keisha Waters at Council on Development Disabilities. How did it reduce the waiting list?
Again, I don't have the numbers at my fingertips. That would have translated to about 100 or so people being moved into, based upon their average per member spend, it would have resulted in somewhere between 100 and 150 people being moved into service. If the task force is interested in those numbers, I can certainly provide them to you. But
yeah, that'd be great. Thanks. I love data.
You and me both. Maine, another project from almost 5 years ago now, looked at rates in 2013. The numbers look identical to New Mexico, but that is a coincidence. We also recommended a rate decrease across the board of about 4%. That was primarily out of their group home services. They have an average cost of group homes of about $325 a day. We recommended a reduction of those services in particular, which would have saved $10 million. This rate study, however, was not implemented. The legislature actually passed legislation in the state that prevented the state from moving forward with implementing these rates, so the rates have not changed. Or more specifically, this rate study was not implemented. Moving on to more recent studies in Mississippi, they're also moving to tiered rates rather than a one-size-fits-all rate schedule, which is what they had in effect before that, where regardless of the individual's level of need, you got a fixed amount for your day program, fixed amount for your residential services. So they don't use assist, they use the ICAP, the inventory for client and agency planning. Took us a number of years ultimately to get approval from CMS for this waiver as well, not because of the rate study, but because of some conflict-free case management challenges that they had. But ultimately, we got approval earlier this year to implement the rates. So that began in May of 2017. And what we recommended and what was fully funded was a 40% increase, or about $20 million.
Excuse me, what is ICAP?
It's an assessment instrument. It stands for the Inventory for Client and Agency Planning. It's used probably in a dozen or so states, IDD systems. Virginia, this is part of a larger initiative to totally overhaul their three waiver programs for people with intellectual and developmental disabilities. They went from a diagnosis-based waiver system to a service-based waiver system. They did also implement the supports intensity scale. And then as part of that work, we did a rate study. We recommended a rate increase of about 9% or $58 million. Ultimately, the state Medicaid agency required us to scale back in some of our nursing rate recommendations for parity across their Medicaid system. So what was implemented and fully funded by the legislature was $45 million, and that study implementation began in 2016. Oregon, your neighbors to the north, we're currently working in. We've done this in two phases. The first phase was looking at their day program and employment services. We recommended rate increases there. Because of the financial challenges that particular agency is facing, they weren't able to implement our increases on the day services side, but did implement the employment rates. And now we're taking a look at residential, respite, and in-home services. We put rates out for comment actually a month or two ago. That comment period closes at the end of the calendar year. So we'll be taking a look at that and largely making modifications to what we proposed. Because of some changes that are taking place in the assessment, I can't tell you how much the new rates are going to cost, but it's going to be a substantial amount. We're looking at pretty dramatic rate increases in Oregon as well. Hawaii, we conducted this rate study over the last couple of years. Just skipping to the bottom line there, we recommended an overall rate increase of 25%. I'm sorry.
Maybe this isn't the time to ask, but it'd be interesting to what changed in your assessments. What made it change? in terms of what the tool you used and the outcomes? Because you said there was a change in assessments.